Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. Welcome. How are you all? It's the 14th of August. Starting off with Joan Jett this morning. Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. They're going to be playing at SPAC on Sunday with the one and only Billy Idol. So we'll be playing some Joan Jett this morning. I thank you all very much for being here. It's very nice to have you here and to be in your company on this Thursday morning. We have wonderful, wonderful, wonderful panelists to talk about the issues of the day. We will get right to it. We also welcome you, our wonderful audience, to take part in this discussion as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you on the various topics that we will be discussing this morning. Let me introduce the group to you. We'll get started. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Good morning. Hope everyone's well today.
Sure.
Yeah, fired up, ready to go. Yeah, I don't want to get started because once I get started, I'm not going to stop.
No, I know. I just have to say, I was out yesterday, and I just this is going to sound like I'm not sincere, but I swear to God, I'm being sincere. But there would be these moments where I would just have a couple of seconds to sort of catch up with life, and I would go in and Teresa had written me they're rants.
I noted at least in one of them was a rant.
It was just great. It was just great. I said, how great is this? Like, because I was feeling like, oh, I don't really know what's good. And then boom.
It all caught up in one rant.
Yeah, it was great.
It was a bulleted rant.
Yes. So I'm very glad you're here today to share your rants with the masses. JP Miller joins us from the Empire Report. Good morning, JP. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You know, I was driving in this morning and I realized that I'm very late on this. Very, 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 very late on this. But right before the 4th of July holiday, there was a concert at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, where Joan Jett and Billy Idol will be performing on Sunday. Well, on this July 3rd concert, it was the group Mumford & Sons.
Mm-hmm. Love Mumford & Sons.
And they were fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And there was this moment where I was just dancing my heart out. And for any of you who can't picture that, either can I. However, at one moment, I got this tap on the shoulder, and I didn't know what it was. I was like, you know, I thought somebody was roughing me up at a Mumford & Sons concert. And I turn around, and it's JP who is handing me a beer and says, here you go.
Good man.
And I thought, wow, that is great. And then I realized that JP is, like, far enough back. And then I also realized that JP and I are the only two people over, like, 6'5". I think that's why we sort of beamed, I think, at that moment. But I didn't thank you. I thanked you at the moment. I don't think I thanked you after that. So,
well, thank you for saying that. It was a lot of fun. And I, too, felt like, although we were far apart with you with much better seats, of course, it felt like it was just you and me in the concert because we are a head taller than everybody else in the concert.
Above.
And I'm like looking. Anytime I look to my left, all I could see was you. And yeah. Despite, you know,
woe,
thousands of other people.
Woe unto the people behind you just wanted to see the band.
Yeah, yes. You know, you hear that all the time. And I do feel for them, but I don't know what to do because
I need to give back. You need to give them like a piggyback ride or something.
Yeah, I mean, I will move if they. But I don't know. It's hard. Now, the other question I had for you because I was then a few weeks later, I was at Jerry Seinfeld. Were you at the Seinfeld show?
I was.
I saw you at the Seinfeld show, and I was going to get ready to get you a beer, and then I couldn't place if it was ultimately you or not because there was no. Lawn seating and the lighting was separate and I kept on looking back, okay, is that JP? And then I thought, well, what's the worst that happens? I buy a stranger a beer. That's fine.
Well, they, first of all, Seinfeld, in my opinion, exceeded my already high expectations.
Yeah.
I thought an hour of new material and it was phenomenal. But they shut down the beer sales about 15 minutes before he went on, which I thought was smart, so that people aren't, you know, us upstate folks, if it was up to us, we would just be going to get beer the whole time. Seinfeld.
Is that true? Has yes, that been yeah. proven?
And, well, yeah. I mean, we were one of the last people, you know, trying to get our beer. But I thought it kept everybody in their seats. It's pretty remarkable to have Saratoga Performing Arts Center, which I think holds something like 5,500 people in the theater portion. I saw maybe less than 10 people get up and use the restroom during the whole concert. But
this sounds
Jerry
like it's going to be a future Seinfeld routine. What's the deal with JP and Joe yeah. going to all the same events?
Yeah, look at that. There's my picture of Seinfeld. Yeah. There was this weird moment where, and I promise we'll get to the news. There was this weird moment where somebody from the audience said, Hey, Jerry, when are you going to do the funny material?
Oh.
And it was just like it stopped the show cold. And then he was funny and sort of came back from it, but he kept on referring to it over and over again. And I thought, well, what's happening there?
Like, why heckle if you're paying money to go and you're a fan, right?
I don't want to get into how much tickets were, but this person was in an inexpensive section. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, just shut up.
It's odd for him to get heckled, but you have to imagine he's been heckled a million times. He's a pro. Mm-hmm. He did a great job. And what I thought remarkable, Joe, was it was like 100 degrees that night.
Yeah.
And Jerry was wearing a full suit with a tie, buttoned up.
Old school.
Buttoned.
Old
school. And I'm thinking, you know, Jerry, you could wear a golf shirt. We would all laugh just as hard. But it was very impressive, him in that suit in that 100-degree weather.
All good stuff. Well, JP, thank you very much. And I'll let you know my future concert schedule and we can meet up. Robert Pondicio is with us, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You're not going to be a Billy Idol, are you?
No, but there's one more before the end of the summer that I'm going to go to.
All right. He was humming. He was humming.
Senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I am well. Had a lovely drive up from Medusa, New York. Nice part of the country any day, but the day after it rains, the sky is washed clear. The cornfields are aglow. It was just a nice morning drive.
Yes, the cornfields are aglow. Some of the earlier corn is starting to tassel, which is really cool. Gives you that idea that fall is indeed coming. Mm-hmm. And, it's just absolutely beautiful. We also welcome Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me back. My drive was not as nice. It was foggy.
It was a little up the thruway.
Yeah.
That's to be endured, not enjoyed.
Yeah, it looked like there was a storm on the horizon, but that's all right. And I just figured it was coming to work. So let's talk about what's going on in the world. We will talk, as we have been mentioning for the last couple days, about the activity in our nation's capital. The District of Columbia, otherwise known as the District. And the president announced that he was going to extend the emergency. So there was the original announcement on Monday of that the city was being riddled by crime and that the National Guard was going to be called in, plus the police force would now be under the control of the federal government. The president said yesterday that the emergency is far worse than he expected. And this morning we're going to focus, I believe, on D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who at the very beginning was sort of playing the political game in the sense of honoring the wishes of the president, saying that her administration would work with his administration to do the best that they possibly could. This is even though her department and the city kept on the narrative that that actually crime had diminished in the city of in the District of Columbia. And so then As the president continued to paint the city as a crime-addled wasteland, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser condemned an on-the-ground a surge in federal resources bolstering D.C. police, which she and the police chief welcomed. The impact of Trump's federal actions came into view Tuesday night with National Guard troops and on the ground and agents from numerous federal agencies roaming D.C. streets from the National Mall to busy corridors in Columbia Heights. At a Wednesday evening checkpoint in Northwest Washington, local and federal officers, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, pulled over drivers for seatbelt violations and broken taillights. The crime is out of control. The White House said the overnight operation would soon become a 24/7 affair because if you're going to have a broken taillight, there's no reason you should just be pulled over at night. With a significantly greater National Guard presence, and Trump said he intended to ask Congress to extend the emergency, allowing him to federalize D.C. police beyond 30 days. We're going to be asking for extensions on that, long-term extensions, because you can't have 30 days, Trump said Wednesday, adding that his administration would be pushing a crime bill to use the city as a very positive example. Spokespeople for Bowser and Attorney General Brian Schwab declined to comment. Trump's executive action represents the most extraordinary federal intervention into the city's home rule in decades, coming as violent crime is at a 30-year low following a historic spike in 2023, according to D.C. police data. So far, top D.C. officials said the order was playing out as more of a collaborative partnership, even as they feared that Trump's repeated denigrations of the nation's capital as a dirty city, unsafe for residents and visitors, could do permanent damage to its image on the national stage. Because one of the letters that I got yesterday from Teresa was on the subject, I would like to begin with her.
I context here, I lived in D.C. in the 80s and 90s. I think you lived in D.C. also. Did you? No.
I work there now. My office is at the American Enterprise Institute, is just off DuPont Circle. I don't live there, obviously. I live up here, but I'm a frequent visitor 10, 12 times a year.
Right. So I think that there's some context is really important here, both about what's going on with the Trump administration, what is the context in which they decide to do this, which is fairly unlawful, and then what's been going on with the Trump administration and D.C. itself before this. I think you have to remember, to me, this is a very, very, very expensive distraction and an unlawful one. But you have to remember that ICE, you know, the ICE detentions, they continue, and there was a lot of public was turning on him because of the type of detention. He claimed that they were going to go after the worst of the worst, but story after story shows that it's, you know, picking up lawful citizens, picking up people with, you know, they were trying to, anyway, there's, detentions are expensive, wasn't going well, needed to get that off the front pages. There's what's going on in Gaza. Just by the way, yesterday, 25 more people were killed by the Israelis as they were trying to access food. More than 100 children dying of starvation recently. And they're just blockading the access to food. And there was media attention on that they needed to shift from. The tariffs, you know, 90 deals in 90 days, not happening. People are feeling the impact of the tariffs in every direction. People understanding the budget bill that was passed is not going to be in their favor. But most importantly is the Epstein situation, where they could not control that message. And I think that they were looking to shift the message. And as so I heard a commentator say last night, and I believe that, you know, his standard go-to when he's in trouble is, you know, anger, race, crime, you know, everything's being unrun and I alone can fix it. But the troubles in D.C., you know, think about what his administration's policies have done to D.C. recently. I mean, they've been reeling from the impacts of COVID, right? And the people not working in the city anymore. But just in the last couple of months, all of these firings of employees, many of them are residents of D.C. who've lost their job, or a lot more people now coming into D.C. to work because they have been fired. Over $1 billion in funding that's been frozen that was scheduled to go to them, and the whole range of federal cuts. And including most recently a 40% cut in security funding. That's law enforcement, community policing programs, and such. And so there's been this Trump administration economic assault on the city. And into that context, he decides to, after what he did in Los Angeles, decide that crime is at an all-time high. Not true. Those statistics are wrong. In fact, they have been reducing crime. It spiked in 2023, but it's gone down. So what does he do? They claim that the numbers are not true, that the crime statistics are not true. Well, you know, that's rich for somebody like him, given what he did with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where he didn't like the numbers, so he fired the person who gave them. But in any case, I think that this is a distraction from the key issues. It's an attempt to shift blame because of the impact of his policies. And it's just a very dangerous takeover. And if you think back, what's the most violent day in Washington since the 60s, right? That's the insurrection. That's an insurrection that he provoked, where over 140 law enforcement officials were brutally beaten while he sat in the White House and did nothing. Right? You want to talk about violent crime out of control. Go back and look at the tapes of what happened on January 6th. And not only did he do that, but then the Justice Department went and legally, lawfully investigated and prosecuted those people. And what did he do when he first came in? He pardoned them, put them back out on the streets. And then not only did he pardon them, but he went out and methodically fired those people within the Justice Department who did those lawful prosecutions. So, you know, and the other thing that I'm going on too long, but the other thing that stuns me is I've been watching, we're supposed to have the 26 appropriations bills passed by October 1st. That's the new fiscal year. Look at what's in those appropriations bills for law enforcement. Deep cuts in violence prevention programs, deep cuts in community policing, deep cuts in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms around all issues relating to the control of gun violence, right? So in this context of, you know, they are going to be the ones that come in and solve the crime problem in Washington, D.C.? Really? Really? And they're going to come in and sweep up homeless people and move them to where? Right? Really? I'm ranting.
No, you're not ranting. I do want to get back to. I want to hear from everyone, and we'll do that. I was going to say I really want to get back to the homeless issue because I think that's paramount here as a real problem,
yes,
with what's being done. So I would like to mention on that, and we can certainly talk about the mayor as well, J.P. Miller.
That was excellent, Teresa. I think it is a. It is a unique time right now that we're in that last week it was announced that New York City has the fewest shootings in the first 6 months of this year ever since they started collecting the statistics, which I believe was 1994. So the fewest number of shootings ever. And that news, the way the media operates, of which we're all kind of part, we're on the radio here, it just, that news doesn't get out there.
Right.
If it was the highest number of shootings, mm-hmm, in a year, it would be on the front page of every newspaper every single day that you could. But also yesterday, the NYPD said overall crime in New York City is down to its lowest level in 25 years. So these are remarkable statistics that you see coming out. And so there is this divide as to what the police are reporting and what the president is,
fabricating,
is promulgating. And And they're also, in addition to that, there's also a stark partisan divide where Republicans, if you poll Republicans, they say crime is out of control. And if you poll Democrats, they say crime is, you know, is in a, at a manageable level. And so this is, as you say, Teresa, an effective tool for Trump to get his base motivated.
Bring them back home.
And helps him politically.
And also, in a common sense world, and... Yeah, we've got that. In a common sense world, if a city was having problems and their numbers were up, let's say slightly, that they would work with the federal government for assistance as opposed to an being overtaken.
I want to hear from other people, but I would, because I worked on in Boston, ran the Safe Neighborhoods program to try to contain violence, and I'd love to, but I don't want to.
Okay. Catherine.
I agree with you, Teresa. This is mostly political theater. It's a distraction from bigger issues. And bringing in more law enforcement, the National Guard, like, it's not going to actually help reduce crime, right? Crime is symptomatic of deeper structural issues. And I think with this case, it highlights two major problems. As Joe noted, homelessness, and the other is juvenile crime. Those two things seem to be what they're fixated on. And with homelessness, as Teresa brought up, ship them out to where? How are we? What does it mean to get rid of homelessness in D.C.? And it's a large population. And, you know, what Trump has done already has not helped the homeless population. He has cut funding for addiction research and treatment grants. He has reduced Medicaid. And these are things that people rely on, vulnerable populations rely on.
If I may just interrupt for one moment, I mean, one other thing about this too, mm-hmm. and I just want to keep this on the front burner, which is this mashing together of violent crime and the homeless.
That's right.
As if to say the homeless is responsible for that violent crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It's conflating the two issues, and that's not what, you know, data support. Yeah,
a little factoid. On homelessness, I was reading, and then I heard it reported yesterday, 0 beds available mm-hmm. for homeless people right now because there's such a backlog. Mm-hmm. 0 beds in D.C. available. Anyway.
Well, I think what they're going to do is just sweep people up and put them in prison, all these private prisons, right? Because where else are they going to go? You can't just make people disappear. Well, I mean, these days,
you
the government is making
disappear.
They are making people disappear. You know, and why not invest in programs that get at the root of the issue as opposed to, like, spending what we're about to spend over $40 billion on detention centers, right? So
private
why not,
prisons.
Mm-hmm. Why not address the root of the issue? Addiction, housing, helping people get employment. And the other issue that's been highlighted is juvenile crime. Similar thing. Why not get to the root of the issue and help these children, right? Yeah. Piero was saying that, you know, they are treated too soft in the justice system. They're given ice cream socials and yoga, which is not what's going on at all. If anything, there's a lot of violence and overcrowding in these detention centers. Also, there's understaffing. There's been reported sexual abuse and physical abuse. So these are not comfortable places. These children are not being coddled in any way.
I have to say, if I were in one of these places and I had to do yoga, that would be cruel and unusual punishment. I have to.
Oh man, I could use some yoga right now.
No, I know. I guess I'm not. I'm not dissing anyone who benefits from yoga. I'm just not one of those people. Robert.
So many thoughts. Okay, let's allow that it's a distraction. Well, we're being distracted by it, then, aren't we? In this very conversation. So, you know, why?
Well, it's a real thing that's happening.
Well, this is exactly my point, Joe. So, I mean, as somebody who does spend a lot of time in Washington, do I feel unsafe there? Not really. Well, I will say this. When I go to D.C., there's a late Amtrak train that if I miss it, I'm stuck in Union Station overnight. And that's happened to me once or twice. And let's just say that there is a palpable sense of menace that accompanies that. I would not recommend.
I agree with you fully, but would that be the case if you were at Union Station in Philadelphia or Penn Station in New York City?
Depends on the time of day, obviously.
Right, but I'm saying at night. I think that's a common thing.
Of course, of course.
Or a Republican-run city in a Republican state. Like
during the day, DuPont Circle, which is a block away from my office, I used to look forward to walking through DuPont Circle on my way to or from my office, and I don't anymore. It's basically it's a homeless encampment. It feels unsafe to walk through it. But look, the larger point I want to make is that it's one thing to talk about, what is the data point we keep hearing, that crime is at a 30-year low, that it's or it's down 35% or both. I think for most Americans, this is not a data-driven phenomenon. It's about the sense of ease, unease, menace, call it what you will, that you feel in your day-to-day life. You don't have to have been a crime victim to feel guarded when you walk around our major cities, and DC is not an exception to this. So I mean, think for a moment about if you want to promote this narrative that, hey, Trump is distracting you from other problems. Well, there you go again. In other words, he is forcing the Democrats into defending the status quo, saying crime isn't so bad when many voters see that as unacceptable. The CVS on DuPont Circle, when I'm down there, literally everything is behind glass. So now you want to be the political party that says, hey, things aren't so bad when people who live in the city have to ask an attendant for a tube of toothpaste. Now, if that's the narrative you want to go with it. But I'm just saying you got to recognize the disconnect between people's daily experience and being told, well, the data says X. Well, people don't necessarily care what the data says. They care about how they feel.
Well, Robert, I agree with you that he is masterful at jamming people up on messaging. But the bottom line is these are real people's lives, and there are real problems and situations, and there are real problems in which if the Trump administration wanted to engage, and I think this is where I applaud the mayor and the police chief trying to sort of maneuver in this situation. If they wanted to make law enforcement available to enhance their work, it would be useful. It could be useful. I, was part of the Safe Neighborhoods Initiative in Boston when violent crime had spiked tremendously in 89, 90, 91. And we put together a comprehensive plan led by Mayor Flynn to try to address that. And that comprehensive plan included using DEA, using the FBI, bringing those federal resources to bear on the situation. But it was in an organized, planned way to, so that everybody did their piece. It wasn't just bringing in a bunch of National Guard with no advance thought or planning about what their role would be, how they could be used. And what I have found interesting and I admire about what the mayor and the police chief have been doing is they haven't been attacking this. They've been trying to sort of message it in the way, okay, yes, we do need more personnel. So we will work, make it clear that they're still in charge, but they will try to engage and work with these folks, find the right purpose for the National Guard.
Is that correct, Teresa? Because I think Joe started this conversation by saying that was the initial response, the D.C. police chief and Bowser saying, we could use the help. But now they're falling into this thing of saying it's over.
I think they're still willing to work with them. They're being critical of the extension, was my understanding.
Yeah, look, I'm making a much simpler point, which is once you turn this into a data-driven argument, I think you're losing the argument.
Well, Trump spewed enormous amounts of data that wasn't true. And he painted this picture of D.C. that's not true. And it is, you're right, for the purpose of trying to put the Democrats in a position of saying, there isn't any crime and we don't like the police. But that's not really the issue here. The issue is, what are their policies and how are their policies driving this problem in the wrong direction? They start the fire and then they come in and say, we're going to put it out. And you, again, you could have a great cooperative effort if indeed it was a thought-out cooperative effort, because they don't have enough police officers. And now they don't have funding for the programs because the Trump administration froze the funding, right? They froze some of their...
Oh, no, I was just going to build on what you were saying, in that I don't think anyone on either side is saying that the current crime rates are fine, right? People are pointing out that crime is going down and looking better, but it's still, it could go down further, right? No one is,
which is what the mayor and the police chief said.
Right, no one is defending the status quo here. But to your point, Teresa, what needs to happen is not just dumping more police enforcement into D.C. in this sort of haphazard, disorganized way, right? It is about figuring out what cities need in order to do better, in order to reduce crime in a more permanent way, a more sustainable way.
We didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning. No, we didn't light it, but we tried to fight it. We'll come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 14th of August. Hearing Joan Jett this morning, who is going to be at SPAC on Sunday. We're talking about what is happening in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the place of my birth. Oh. And I must say that it is... you know, I got the cutest birth certificate from there. It was like a little credit card, and on the back of the credit card were these mini reductions of my footprints.
Aww.
That's sweet.
Yeah,
aww.
It was very, very, very cute. I don't think they'd help me today. But my thanks to everyone who has written in. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those in just a moment. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we look forward to that. Am I missing anybody else on any other factoid that you'd like to get in before we go to the letters?
Well, the only other thing that we haven't gotten to, and I don't know if we want to do it now or later, is that at that very bizarre press conference at the Kennedy Center, the other thing he talked about D.C. was how he needs to remake it. We're going to clean it up. We're going to pave the streets. We're going to do all of that. And then he fixated on the parks.
Fix the subways down there, for pity's sake. Man, they used to be glorious. I remember the first time I saw the D.C. subway in the late 70s, early 80s, I felt like I was in Disneyland. Have you seen those subways down
there? Metro.
Oh, yeah.
The Metro.
Yeah,
the Metro.
Yeah.
The Metro was one of the greatest transportation systems in all of the country.
Because I was used to riding the graffiti-covered subways in New York City.
Correct.
And I remember walking down into the subways in D.C. and literally laughing. Like, I couldn't believe a subway could look like this. I'd never seen anything like it. And now, every time I go down there, the elevators don't work. I posted a video on Facebook a couple years ago of getting to the top of the escalator in DuPont Circle, and there was literally an 18-inch hole that went 30 feet down to the tracks, and you could see people standing over it, and it was dangerous.
Well, it was to solve the escalator problem that you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Those escalators are so
what's the largest
so
one?
Long.
Right?
Yeah,
people have explained to me why the escalators are a chronic problem in D.C., but that to me is my D.C. barometer is the subways, and they are a mess down there.
Well, he didn't mention the subways, but he did go on and on about the parks and about grass, and he knows about grass because he has golf. And he spent an enormous amount of time talking about grass. It was just bizarre. The whole press conference was just a stream of consciousness. If any other president had done that, it would have been headlines.
Teresa, we need to update your Netflix queue, get you watching a series on Hulu.
No.
This is taking up much of your time.
I had to watch it because it was crazy.
Okay.
I have it on in the background. I'm doing other things, but it did disturb me, so I did send you a rant. But in any case... One of the things.
We need an intervention.
But no.
I want to keep getting my rants, please.
You know, 54 minutes of life I can't get back, but I highly recommend go look at it, especially when he's talking about Gloria Gaynor. But in any case, he ranted about the grass.
What did he say about Gloria Gaynor?
She will survive.
We'll get to that later. We'll get to that.
Yeah. But he went in great detail about the grass and the parks. But what he didn't seem to note is that a lot of the parks in D.C. are part of the national park system. And one of the problems that I'd been reading about before this in D.C. was that the national park system, they have such deep cutbacks mm-hmm. in funding that the parks are not being kept up all around the country. And it's particularly a problem in Washington, D.C. because it's such a part of the tourist, you know, and the community there.
Well, so much of the city is under the thumb of the national park system.
And because the Trump administration has had such deep, deep cuts, the parks aren't being kept up. And there he was ranting. I said, did anyone tell him that it's his people? So if you're not sure what to do with the National Guard, maybe they could work on the parks. I don't know. but it just makes no sense. Like, deep cuts in the programs for homeless people, and he's going to come in and he's going to move them?
Right, but he's causing all of these. He's contributing to these issues and then wondering why they're so bad.
And Russ Vought and J.D. Vance, they're advocating for this budget bill that's going to pass by October 1st to have a 54% cut mm-hmm. in the HUD budget to essentially almost eliminate the Section 8 program, the home program, community economic development, all of those things
really
that build community.
Help, the home
and does he think he has a homeless problem now? I mean, mm-hmm. just wait.
The other thing, too, and we'll just spend a second on this, but the... and I don't think it's been really clear, but he has mentioned a few times that what is happening in Washington is a pilot project for what he wants for other states or other cities, which I believe there's at least five other cities.
Always cities that are run by Democratic mayors and in many cases African-American Democratic mayors. But again, if you want to go to the data, Robert, if you look at the crime statistics, the highest crime rates are actually in cities that are run by Republican mayors. Go ahead.
Okay, let's go to our letters. Russ says, put 800 National Guard troops on street corners and crime will likely decline on those corners. However, that's 800 people on leave from their jobs who will eventually have to leave. And no one has suggested that anything will have changed once they are gone. Melanie says, it's not a distraction. It's a part of the plan. It's serious. It's scary. It's time for the American people to get it and fight it. Then, yes.
I think that needs to be focused on because, and I probably didn't say it, but the one thing that's, to me, deeply, deeply troubling about this is I do believe that they are trying to normalize the use of troops, of military personnel in American streets. And that is dangerous. And the generals need to be, they've started to talk about how dangerous it is and what a problem it is. That is not supposed to happen in the United States of America. He did it in Los Angeles. He's doing it here. He's threatening to do it in other places. Tom Honan, his ICE guy, was at the White House yesterday, did a quick, he was asked about, you know, how long this was going to last. And he said it's not just arrest, it's deterrence. Just having this presence be there deters crime. And they said, well, what happens after the 30 days? It's allowed by law when the president doesn't have, his authority is over. And his response was, the president's authority is never over. Now, that's chilling.
Yeah.
If you care about the Constitution, that's chilling. And Republicans in the House and Senate, I know it's Pollyannish for me to say this, but they should hear that statement and they should be concerned by it.
Let's go to Pamela, who says, what I want to know is what are the white collar crime rates and trends in Washington, D.C.? We go to Cheryl. I disagree with what is happening in our cities as political theater. It may be a temporary distraction, but military presence sent by the president has the hallmarks of an authoritarian takeover of our country. Project 2025, we were warned.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Then we check in with Michael. Joe, I noticed that you said that federal law enforcement officers are, quote, roaming the streets of Washington, D.C. I believe that those with a differing viewpoint would say that they are patrolling the streets, traveling around an area and observing to improve the public safety. Roaming means wandering around without a purpose. I will say I was reading an article, as I mentioned, from the Washington Post. I do think that's the point that they are making, however, that because there isn't that much activity, that they are not patrolling, they are doing more roaming because there really isn't that much to do otherwise unless they get hit by a sandwich.
And that's what the police chief and the mayor were, I think, trying to convey, is that they wanted to meet and work with them to try to fill in some of the gaps, create a purpose, because this was done not in a planned way. It wasn't done in a way where they all talked about, well, what were their needs? What's the gaps? How can we fill them? It just, you know, they heard the announcement, we're coming in, we're taking over. And so it seemed to me what the mayor and the police chief were trying to do is to give them some specified purpose so this doesn't get out of control.
Well, and I think that's part, kind of how it went with last year when Governor Hochul brought the National Guard into the subways because she was concerned about subway crime.
But it was coordinated.
They coordinated with the NYPD. And I do think that bringing the National Guard in at that time, the governor's office would tell you that that benefited and lowered crime with the presence of the National Guard to augment the NYPD. And, you know, whether they're roaming or patrolling, I don't really know what the difference of roaming and patrolling is. You know, the I think their goal is to have a presence. Mm-hmm. The criminals are going to be less likely to commit crimes if there's police and or National Guard there. Is that
and
fair?
It's that feeling of
absolutely
safety.
Absolutely.
It's this idea that, hey, you know, I'm safe. There's, you know, there's people watching out here. I feel safe on this subway.
And, you know, they were talking about, well, they have a backlog of U.S. Marshals, warrants, whatever, and they could use some of them to do that, execute these warrants. So some of the things that they have the ability to do. Or, you know, maybe they could be in Union Station, whatever. There are a range of things that they could do, but you need to have it coordinated, discussed, planned.
I'm kind of shocked they're not there anyway, because I'd always feel, I don't go to Washington, D.C. a lot, but I always feel like there's a lot of police officers with long guns and people in camo, and it's hard for me to tell who's police and who's National Guard and who's National Park Service. It seems like there's already a big federal law enforcement presence when I go to Washington, D.C. I guess I'm usually going for touristy stuff.
Well, and especially those tourist sections. I mean, you walk around the mall or in the aforementioned monument area where you have the Lincoln Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial, World War II Memorial, Korean Memorial, JFK, FDR, or MLK.
Right. Jefferson. A big combination of metropolitan and park police presence in my experience always.
The perception of safety thing is interesting because who is perceiving safety when there are a lot of law enforcement around, right? So maybe, you know, for me, maybe I'm like, okay, well, I might perceive it to be safe. But if you are someone who is black or brown and knowing that you're more likely to be the target of police violence, I don't think they feel safe.
I could argue that. Excuse me. I could argue that one round or flat. I'm just remembering when I taught a high school civics seminar at a charter school in New York City. I like to design the course around just like it was almost like the roundtable. You know, mm-hmm. we'd bring issues in the news in and just debate them among high school seniors. And one year when Stop and Frisk was in the news, you know, we did a unit on that. And my students, all of whom were black and brown, kind of surprised me. They were strongly in favor of a police presence in the subway because it was a charter school and they were commuting from distances away. I expected them to say what you just said, but I'd say it was 80-20. They were in favor of a strong police presence. They didn't have a problem with Stop and Frisk.
And I do think if, again, just back to my Boston experience, if you have a strong community policing component, if you have an active effort to work in a collaborative way, you know, you they welcome, in many cases, a police presence, but it has to be done in a way that's you know, a cooperative effort, and it's 10 o'clock, sir.
Complicated questions.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. We'll be talking much more about them, I'm sure, in the future. In the meantime, we're going to take a news break. And just a break. And we'll also be back to tackle new subjects. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we welcome you. We'll be back after this news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. I love Joan Jett doing the Mary Tyler Moore theme.
I have never heard that before.
Isn't that great?
I'm having flashbacks with Joan Jett to doing my first job in radio in Oneonta when Joan Jett was at the peak of her popularity. I did not know she recorded the Mary Tyler Moore theme.
And as you listen to that, you can just see Mary in the grocery store with the meat and just sort of
your mind it's automatic. Yeah. Your mind goes there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm thinking of Mary Tyler Moore as a goth,
and just throwing the hat into the air. That's great stuff. Good morning. Welcome back to the
show.
It certainly was. Oh my God. Welcome back to the program. We have a lot to talk about and we have a wonderful panel to do it. Teresa Bourgeois is with us, public policy and communications expert. Thank you very much. J.P. Miller is from the Empire Report. Robert Pondicio is senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Catherine Tan is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. And we welcome you all to the program and thank you for taking the time to share with our listeners. Let's move on to other topics. The big story today will be even a bigger story tomorrow as the President of the United States has a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. European leaders said on Wednesday that they had hammered out a strategy with President Trump for a scheduled meeting with Putin on Russia on Friday in Alaska to discuss ending the war in Ukraine, including an insistence that any peace plan must start with a ceasefire and not be negotiated without Ukraine at the table. The transatlantic discussions on Wednesday were a last-minute effort by European leaders to close ranks with Mr. Trump ahead of the Friday meeting. They came in a video call arranged by the Chancellor of Germany and included Mr. Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, and several other European leaders with strong relationships with Mr. Trump, including the Prime Minister of Italy. Mr. Zelensky traveled to Berlin for the meeting and briefed reporters afterwards. We had a truly exceptional, constructive, and good conversation with the president, said Mr. Mertz. He told reporters there is hope for movement. There is hope for peace in Ukraine. Mr. Trump is, this is, again, I just want to make sure that you know that this is from the New York Times. Mr. Trump is famously mercurial, including on the issue of Ukraine, at several points in recent weeks as European allies have believed that they were succeeding in bringing him on board with their strategies, only for him to warn to Mr. Putin's overtures, as he did in agreeing to the hastily scheduled bilateral meeting. Who would like to begin on the issue of Russia? My goodness, you all seem so excited. JP, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. President Trump is hugely motivated for a deal. He campaigned on bringing peace to this issue. He's been promising peace. He said that the war would end on day one of his presidency. It says thus far proved elusive for him. As we all know, the big problems here is that Vladimir Putin wants concessions to end the war, and he wants to take stuff back to his people and to the media and say, hey, here's why I did it. Look at these victories. And of course, Vladimir Zelensky on the other side does not want to give up those concessions. He does not want to, you know, to give Putin the things that he wants. And so we are in a stalemate. It doesn't seem like either Putin nor Zelensky are motivated to end the war. It doesn't seem like either of them really want to end the war. It seems like the people that want to end the war the most is the United States. And so I don't know what will come of this meeting. It's hard to imagine that we're going to get a peace deal out of it because Zelensky's not going to be there, right?
Correct.
Right.
So hard to imagine a peace deal.
Uninvited. Not invited.
But that's what I've got on it.
Catherine?
Well, I'm not confident about this at all. But, I mean, for so long, Trump was trying to court Putin's favor, right? He wanted to be best friends with this guy. So what I can't see that really changing. And how is that going to impact the meeting on Friday, right? Is he still poised to make concessions and do what he thinks Putin wants to see? Meeting on Friday, I don't think anything promising is going to come out of it.
What you looking at me for? I wasn't invited.
What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, look, this is obviously far from my area of expertise. Yeah. So this is, you know, when I have my white knuckle moments on the round table of having to, you know, flap my jowls about things about, you know, I have no better opinion than the guy in the bar stool next to me. But I guess what I could share is some of the...
We should have had bar stools.
and beer.
Yes.
I can share the perspectives of some of my, you know, right-of-center colleagues on this who are better informed. The conventional wisdom on the right is like, look, this is a necessary risk in a stalemated war. It's a test of Trump's deal making in terms of what they hope to see him accomplish. Aiming for a verifiable ceasefire as a foundation with Ukraine's buy-in, obviously. What he should not accept, vague land swaps without Ukraine's consent or rewards for Russian aggression. Do I expect any of that to come out of Friday? Who knows? But, you know, I find it refreshing at least that we're not having the same conversation we had last time about this on the roundtable when I was on, which is like, oh, look, this violates norms and, you know, they're supposed to go into these things with a deal in place and this becomes a ceremony. Who cares? Like, this has gone on long enough. The fact that I still find it difficult to take exception to a face-to-face meeting. If something good comes from it, fantastic.
I guess, well, one of the big concerns is Trump accidentally, or I don't know if accidentally is the right word, but opening up the possibility of some sort of land swap, right? Because then that would give Russia a greater advantage, and also right. it would open up the possibility of them encroaching into other regions.
Yeah, that's the rewarding Russian aggression that you know folks are rightly concerned about. But one assumes, right, mm-hmm. that doesn't happen without Ukraine's approval.
Well, right, and they've already sounded off on that. Right. So, right.
But how do you assume that, Robert?
Say again, please.
I mean, how do you, you know, like
Trump cannot negotiate away Ukrainian territory. He's not the king of the world. He's the president of the United States.
But. Do you think that he has that perception?
Well, it doesn't matter whether he has that perception or not. It's beyond his authority. He can't do it.
Well, what he's been doing in D.C. after 30 days is beyond his authority. What he's doing on a whole lot of things is beyond his authority, but he's still trying to do it. But, I mean, he can just stop all funding, right? And in fact, they have slowed down the arms packages to Ukraine and cut a lot of the humanitarian funding, and so that they're going into these negotiations with Ukraine at a weaker hand than they might be otherwise. But that, I think, is the fundamental issue in why you would, you know, some of us in, you know, as part of the conversation the last time, where you would, in theory, you would go in better prepared. At least they did have the call yesterday with the allies so that the allies could remind him. But if he wanted to, Trump could just stop all funding for military assistance to Ukraine And there's a the Senate and House Republicans have a package that's been sitting waiting to be approved and go forward, and they have the votes for it, but they've not done it. Now, whether they would go against him or not and what would happen then, who knows? But the question is he going to just agree to something, or is he going to actually get NATO buy-in and Ukraine buy-in? And I don't know that it's as matter assumed that he's going to do that. I think that's one of the concerns that the allies have, yeah. which is a reflection of a real realigning of U.S.'s position in the world.
Well, nobody's suggesting, at least I hope nobody's suggesting, that the United States and the president have no influence here. Obviously, they do. But the point remains, there's not an agreement until the warring parties agree. He cannot impose his will upon either party.
Correct. Hopefully. But he can say that there's an agreement and try to force Ukraine's hand, and then we'll see what NATO and Ukraine do. And then he could stop funding, just like he could, you know, he could alter what's going on with the Israelis in Gaza right now by, you know, shifting the resources that are going to Israel, mm-hmm. right? And that would have a very strong influence. And so that's been one of the questions and one of the concerns about, I know, you know, the issue of preparation is you say it doesn't really matter that much, but, I mean, I think that is a big issue. And many of the experts say that Putin has already gotten one of the fundamental things that he wanted here, which is the face-to-face meeting that does, in diplomatic circles, have meaning. And there is concern about how far Trump will go, because Trump wants to end the war. And yes, we all agree with this, but what NATO and Ukraine's concerned is in what way, at what cost, and Putin is in this for the long haul. He understands these issues deeply, and it's not clear that Trump does. He's at least part of the meeting is going to be one-on-one. And so I think there's a big concern about what's going
to
happen.
Can I go back to something JP said, which surprised me, because you clearly know more about this than I do, sir. You said that neither Ukraine or Russia wants to end this war? I was kind of gobsmacked.
My opinion.
That. Okay.
I'm not saying that they don't want to, but neither of them seem to be in a rush to, right?
Interesting.
Neither of them seem, to me, that motivated. If Ukraine was desperate to end this war, there's things that they could do to give to Russia to end the war, right? If Russia was desperate to end this war, they could end the war. And they could have done that. It's now, how many years has this been going on?
Over three.
Right,
three,
over 3 years. So it's not that they don't want to, but neither of them, to me, seem motivated to.
My perception, and it's ill-informed, is that both parties would probably love to have the opportunity to end the war, to just extricate themselves from this, at what price remains to be seen. But
right.
Well, isn't that really, I mean, a nuance of what you're saying? I think, again, this is, you know, I wish, I am so not an expert in this. It's only the Middle East I know less about. But they're both so complicated and so layered. But isn't really what you're saying is that they don't see a clear path that the war could end in a way that would be acceptable to them?
Yeah, they both
they
both have things that they're not willing to give to end the war.
Right.
Both of them.
It's
have,
not that they either would be glad it was over, but they both want it over in a very different way, and there's not a clear path to agreement.
Yeah, they both have deal killers that the others aren't willing to come to terms on.
Right.
And so when you have multiple deal killers, when the other won't come to terms on, you have stalemate.
A stalemate. And it's not that they wouldn't wish it over, but it's a stalemate,
sure,
and they can't find a pathway to it being
sure.
over. I think that's what you really
Ukraine
said,
wants the war to end on their terms.
And
Russia wants the war to end on their terms.
And they're nowhere close.
And
look at a map. You can see there's a whole map where Russia has taken over key parts of Ukraine's land, and much more so in the last month or two. And they've depopulated these areas, and they want to hold them, and Ukraine doesn't want them to hold them.
So you have the allies yesterday coming and saying,
"Don't give it all
okay,
away."
Okay, this is what you please don't do. Don't say do this. What can you just? And they came out of that meeting as happy as you could asked them to be, I think, in the sense of they felt that they were heard, they felt that it was addressed, and even Zelensky said that this seems to be a good path. So while I, you know, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, you at least look at it as of right now, and the fact that this is the information that they've given them, they've prepped their representative, and you hope it moves forward in a positive direction.
And the White House has lowered expectations as low as they could get without canceling it, right? It's about as the expectations are about as low as possible. Trump made a point yesterday in that rambling, whatever it was, at the Kennedy Center to talk about the follow-up meetings, and maybe the next one could be quick, which is a signal that he has no, you know, belief that they're going to have any final. He said there'll be meeting or meeting after that. So they've done everything possible to lower expectations. And I think the key for NATO, right, is that he just doesn't go and try to give it all away.
Well, and also it is remarkable that we have been funding this war to the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars. We are paying for every bullet and every rocket that gets sent into Russia, and they're going to have a face-to-face meeting. That's remarkable to have two people who are engaging in a proxy war against each other.
Well, NATO's
via their countries, and that they're going to have a face-to-face meeting. That's remarkable and historic.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's why some are concerned who do this as their business that there isn't the type of preparation that you usually have for a situation like this, and also that it's on a military base, also that it's in Alaska, so on and so forth.
When you have President Putin saying that the United States is making great efforts to end the war in Ukraine, is not to be overly cynical, but is that good or bad?
Well, I think just there's this lingering question because of the way Trump has framed this for so long. Is Trump going in there on behalf of Ukraine, or he's more in the middle trying to broker something between the two of them? Like, where, or is he on Russia's side? That's the what deal? And Robert, maybe you can speak to this. You know, what deal is he really trying to broker for? You know, what are his guidelines for the deal of what he thinks?
I'm not sure I could add any, you know, light there. But you have to remember that Trump's base does not like this war at all. I mean, you know, the MAGA Republicans, as it were, don't want us to have any foreign involvement whatsoever. So that would be the win for Trump, is to end this so he could say to his base, you know,
right.
What was it he said? I'm going to end this on day one or whatnot. You know, that, yeah. But that was the reason we shouldn't be involved. I don't, for what it's worth, I don't agree with that. I mean, obviously we are, we have a stake in the outcome here. But his base is not in favor of this conflict.
A couple of letters before we take a break at the bottom of the hour. Ellen says, if I lived in Alaska, I'd be worried. Do you think Trump knows Alaska's history? I bet Putin does. That from Ellen. Then we go to Mike.
Meaning Russia's control of Alaska, is that right. Actually she's alluding to?
Wouldn't it be something if Putin planted his flag over there? Would that be...
He can see Alaska from his house.
Yes. Mike says Trump.
Tina Fey or?
Well, I think
Sarah Palin line said that I can see Russia.
Mike says Trump has already gotten what he wants out of the Alaska meeting. We are all talking about the Alaska meeting rather than Epstein. Epstein has disappeared from the headlines. Then we go to Karen. Does anyone remember that Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons in exchange for security? Mm. Which, by the way, they did not get when Putin invaded their country.
Exactly right.
John says it's absurd to prognosticate that Zelensky and Ukraine don't want to end the war. That is an indefensible comment, according to John. Then we go to Carol, who says it's hard to conceive of giving Trump any credit whatsoever. Remember that Trump left the Afghan political leadership out of negotiations with the Taliban, and surprise, Taliban takeover. Why give this man credit for anything? Then we go to this, which is from Russell. Why does Donald Trump want to end the war? What is he going to get out of it? The Nobel Peace Prize? If it's all about him, I want to know why he is doing this.
Can you go back to that comment about Trump and the Afghans? That didn't happen under Trump. That happened under Biden. The Afghan pullout?
The negotiation
before.
You were assuming that I don't immediately delete the message after I read it.
Okay. No, but, just.
But
what
I
led
will,
up to?
I
Biden's
will try to get back to it during the break and offer some.
But can
some
I mention as an aside
details.
about the Afghan war and Trump? All of those people, the Afghanistan folks who helped U.S. troops, and even to the very end, and who were promised safe passage out of Afghanistan and who were trying to come to this country. The Trump administration is now questioning their status here in this country, and I just find that despicable. And we should all try to help to keep those people who protected our military to help them stay in this country.
Strongly agreed, but again, that pullout happened under the previous president.
Well, but the military and diplomatic actions that happened in advance of it, under the Trump administration, is, I believe, what the letter writer was talking about, and certainly what's happening now with giving legal citizenship status to those people who helped is not Joe Biden's fault. This is happening on Trump's watch, and it's despicable.
All right, 2 minutes. 1 minute and two letters. Here we go. We go to Molly. If Trump wants to swap land, he should give Alaska back to Russia.
I tell you, I've been reading again, but this is being discussed on Russian TV, as I've just recently learned. This is a very real thing for them.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss on this Thursday edition of the Roundtable Panel. We welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Robert, Catherine, JP, and Teresa with us, and we'll have another half hour to discuss the news of the day. First, we'll have some messages and news from the BBC. I remember as a kid when that song was on, trying to match that primal scream. Ow! It just hurt your throat. Good for her.
Such a powerful memory trigger, music, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh man,
just good, brings back so
good,
much.
Good stuff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion for this 14th day of August. So let's talk about, while we're talking about Joan Jett, let's talk about arts. Let's talk about the Kennedy Center, and let's talk about the announcement that was made yesterday by the President of the United States. Now, as you will remember, at the beginning of the administration of this administration, Trump 2.0, I believe it's being called, which is something it just annoys me, but I will use it as a general reference point, that this is... He has had a bug in his bonnet about the Kennedy Center for quite a while, about it being overly woke. They got rid of a bunch of people on the board. They put a bunch of Trump supporters on the board. And then who takes over the command? Well, the president himself, Donald Trump. Now, he announced yesterday the recipients of the 48th Kennedy Center honors. And he did this yesterday. The first class of honorees since he took over the arts complex this year, and a major change to the ceremony. He will be the host. And then I started to think, like, I don't remember, have there been, like, key hosts in the past? It just seems to me that it was sort of always a, you had somebody come on and would introduce like the Dionne Warwick segment, and then somebody who would then move on and go to the, you know, the David Letterman segment, whatever the case may be. And I don't really remember that. But anyway, so he'll be the host. Speaking from the center's Hall of Nations, Trump revealed the 2025 honorees for unveiling five portraits draped in velvet. The group, glam metal band Kiss. Now that means that all, how many members? Five. Five members of Kiss will be inducted into the Kennedy Center.
I'm embarrassed. I could probably name them all.
Go.
Gene Simmons, Ace Frehley, Paul Stanley, and who am I forgetting? There's four of them.
Peter
Criss. Chris. Very
there
good.
There you go. Okay.
And I don't even like Kiss.
And
they dress up how? Like and all. Trump hates drag. I mean, seriously.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call it
Kiss
drag.
Kiss is not drag. Come on.
But dress up. Makeup. All that.
Cosplay.
Yeah, well,
they
have done that. They have not done that.
This is not my area.
Okay.
Sure.
All right.
What I'm just saying is, given his rants and raves, I just found that to be kind of funny.
And by the way, Joe, I just Googled who has hosted the Kennedy Center honors in the past. Some notable hosts include Leonard Bernstein, Walter Cronkite, Caroline Kennedy, Stephen Colbert, more recently Gloria Estefan, LL Cool J, David Letterman, and Queen Latifah.
Oh, there you go.
The president's always up in the president's box with the recipients and their special guests.
Never president, but we've had a queen.
Broadway and West End star Michael Crawford of Phantom of the Opera fame will be inducted.
Don't you have to be an American? He's a Brit, right? Crawford, I'm sorry. I'm confusing him with the man who wrote Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yes. Yeah. Country music legend George Strait will be
going into the
Hall of Fame. Actor Sylvester Stallone, Rocky, Rambo. Sylvester Stallone goes into
friend of Trump's.
Huh?
Friend of Trump's.
Is
friend
he?
Of Trump's, yes. Supporter, friend.
Okay. Who knew?
But I don't know. I will say. Well, I'll hold
just
my comments.
The whole cage fighting on the other.
I'll hold my comments on that in a second. And singer Gloria Gaynor.
I will survive.
Are you queuing it up?
Oh, there it is.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. And I grew strong. And I learned how to get along. And saw your back from my face. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second, you'd be back to bother me. Oh, now go. Walk out the door. Just turn around now. Cause you're not.
It is Gloria Gaynor who will be inducted with the aforementioned group.
And WAMC listeners, be glad this is radio and not television. The scene that you just missed in the Roundtable studio.
It was just dancing. Great.
For some of us, that's the theme of how we're going to get through these 4 years.
One of the things that I found interesting, too, is that actor Tom Cruise was offered the honor but declined because of scheduling conflicts. According to several current and former Kennedy Center employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to publicly discuss event plans, a spokesperson for Cruise declined to comment. Before naming the honorees, Trump said he always wanted the award himself
for The Apprentice,
but was never able to get one. I waited and waited and waited, and I said, the hell with it. I'll become chairman, and I'll give myself an honor.
Wait, did he really say that?
Yes.
That's hilarious.
At this press conference.
That's hilarious.
Can I add? And then he talked about how his ratings for The Apprentice were higher than other award shows, so there.
I know that, you know, this is not on brand for the roundtable, but every now and then you got to acknowledge the guy's funny. Come on, that's a funny thing
to say.
It is
a funny thing to say. I agree with you. And
I don't think he was being funny.
I think he was serious. That's what's funny. I don't know.
He wasn't
joking.
He wants the. He wanted.
I do think that. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. He
it's
he wants the
award. Funny
that
what's going on in his head. He said out loud. He said the quiet
He drew chuckles from a crowd that included Kennedy Center President Richard Grinnell, Senator Lindsey Graham, and members of the White House staff. Next year, we'll honor Trump. Okay, he said. The choices may surprise some Trump critics. When Trump took over the Kennedy Center, an overworked joke circulated on social media. Can you imagine forthcoming Kennedy Center honors for Lee Greenwood, the Village People, and Kid Rock? Inevitable with Trump as chair, prepare your stomach. So this was a far different list. It certainly seemed as if Trump had major plans in store for the honorees. At a board meeting in March, Trump said, we'll go slightly more conservative, if you don't mind, with some of the people. There are people out there that would not be considered that are much bigger stars than the ones that were being honored. He even suggested offering honors to deceased icons and widening the scope of possible recipients to include athletes, business luminaries, and politicians. Forgetting the part about the Kennedy Center for the Arts.
Right.
Perhaps the most surprising thing about Trump's class of honorees is how comfortably it fits in with those who came before it. A-list actor? Check. Aging rock band? Check. Broadway star? Yep. The Washington Post recently reported that the center was seriously considering Strait, Crawford, and Kiss in prior years.
Hmm. Well, he was not... He did not care about the Kennedy Center honorees in his first administration. So something happened between then and now. Someone on his side is saying, hey, you know, helping him recognize that the arts is a powerful political tool, right? This is supposed to be an apolitical event, and he is explicitly politicizing this, condemning what do you say, woke artists, and that we will not be honoring woke artists or whoever he considers to be woke, right? But I think we should take this seriously because on one hand, it is kind of funny. He's talking about wanting to give himself this honor. But politicians taking control of the arts is sort of in the authoritarian handbook here, right? Stalin edited poetry translations and rewrote opera lyrics. He rejected musical works that he couldn't whistle to. The Nazis, they rejected Cubism, Expressionism, Impressionism, like modern art, basically, and removed them from German public institutions, calling them degenerate art, right? Around that time, they were also removing Jewish art dealers, forcing them to leave Germany and creating, you know, opportunities for those who were approved by the Third Reich. And, you know, the arts that they considered to be good were things like from the Dutch masters, French, you know, 18th century French art, artworks, classical Greek, Roman. And this is sort of also Trump's, like, taste and flavor as well, right? He appreciates realism. His taste in art and culture is not great. That's not what he is known for. But this is sort of, you know, basic authoritarian stuff here. So I think this is quite serious. I mean, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, we're like, okay, whatever. Kennedy Center, ours, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on. We have, you know, we have Gaza, we have Russia, Ukraine, we have the Epstein files. But I think this is, you know, another piece in him asserting control. You know, this is very much in flavor of sending in the National Guard into D.C., L.A.
I'll meet you halfway. I'll take it semi-seriously. and what I mean by that is I don't think I'm this is an outrageous statement to say that the arts in general are, you know, extremely, if not stridently, left-leaning, right? I mean, that's not a surprising thing.
No,
to
the
say,
right, like, they make art too.
Well, no, they do, but I mean, what I mean, like, watch the Oscars, the Golden Globes, the speeches, etc. So, look, you know, what I would, I don't view this as authoritarianism, and I'm not a big Kiss fan. I'm a big George Strait fan. But look, you know, part of this president's brand is, I don't want to call it culture war. In this case, it's literal culture. I view this as creating a permission structure for it to be okay to be on the right and in the arts, right? And think of, for example, what just happened a week or so ago with Sydney Sweeney, you know, this kind of ridiculous controversy about how that jeans ad was supposedly like a, you know, a Nazi dog whistle or whatnot. Did you see the follow-on story where the big controversy was that somebody surfaced that she's a registered Republican? Like, in other words, it's just not... I don't want to say it's not permissible because obviously it's not illegal, but it's not common for our celebrities to be identifiably right leaning. Look at that list that Joe
but
read
the,
it for.
You
we're
know,
going to
the,
have
the
Kid
Sweeney,
Rock and
the
and
Sweeney thing. First of all, I had no idea who she was until all of this became a thing.
Me but, either.
But it was, you know, I think it was manufactured outrage because I forgot
well, I
where
agree.
I was reading this. But, you know, first it was the right saying, you know, cherry picking these TikTokers who were coming out saying, oh, you know, what she's saying is like, you know, pro-eugenicist. And then that story was blown out of proportion. And of course, that would bring out a lot of people from the left to, you know, to offer a counter viewpoint to what the right is saying. And that whole thing I thought was just really silly. And with this is different because this is an established institution. This has a lot of cultural significance in our society. And he is explicitly politicizing it, right? Like he's talking about sticking it to woke artists.
Right. But I mean, my point, and I don't want to overstate the case, is we got a long way to go before we have to worry about the arts being overly politicized from the right. I mean, this is an extremely left-dominated industry, if you like.
Yeah.
It seems hard to extricate the two subjects, though, because we are so polarized. You know, you talk about, like, Sylvester Stallone, for example, being a supporter of Trump and someone who campaigned for him and went out on the campaign trail. Okay.
That's fine.
That is fine. But as a 57-year-old, soon to be 58, I grew up with Sylvester Stallone and saw him in everything.
Yeah.
And he was very much a part of my life, very much a part of the art scene, the movie scene, and spent a lot of money going to see his films and other things. So I don't, regardless of his political leanings, I don't know, we'll never know, would he have been inducted without Trump being at the helm? I don't know, but it certainly seems to me that he is somebody who has warranted it. He is an Oscar-winning actor. He has certainly had great success in just about everything that he has touched. I don't know.
Well, I'll go a little sideways here on this because one of my concerns about Trump is that you know, since he's been back in office, what has he done about the arts, right? What has he done? He's targeted key arts culture. I mean, the Smithsonian, mm-hmm. you know, he's going after the Smithsonian, both their budget and how they run the place, the National Endowment for the Humanities, mm-hmm. Library of Congress. He wants to zero fund those initiatives. He, early in May, arts organizations, small community-based important arts organizations around the country all started getting these emails informing them that their grants would be quote-unquote clawed mm-hmm. back, you know, they'd be taken back. So they have, you know, part of the Project 2025 playbook, is to defund these organizations. So that's one thing of concern about where he stands with the arts. And then in but he says that he made this, again from the story, unsubstantiated claims that since becoming chairman of the Kennedy Center, quote, we've completely reversed the decline of this cherished national institution. We ended the woke political programming. We're restoring the Kennedy Center, premier venue for performing arts anywhere in the world. Well, the way that they're doing that ignores what the Kennedy Center was. I mean, it came out of initially the idea from Eleanor Roosevelt that took, you know, a long time to blossom into a decision by President Eisenhower to move forward with, have one cultural institution that would, in the U.S. Capitol, that would be the showcase for the world. Ultimately, it wasn't until John Kennedy moved this idea forward several presidents later and actually raised the money. But it was built on the idea that it would be a bipartisan institution. Mm-hmm. And the building is run by the government, but the programming is done by a separate group. And the board has always been bipartisan. The focus has always been bipartisan. And it's now he took it under his control. And it's his institution. He wants to change the building. He wants to change what's happened in the building. So my concern is not so much who these five that were picked, but what he's done to this institution that for so long was designed and has been run as a bipartisan cultural beacon. And so that's what worries me. Maybe that's a little too wonky, but...
No, it's not wonky.
Far beyond who these five were picked, to me, it's really deeply concerning and disappointing that even the Kennedy Center, mm-hmm. He's politicizing, and just because he wants to dominate everything.
Right. That's right. It's not so much about like who is being honored this year or even next year, but it is the larger gesture of seizing control of this institution.
Right.
And seizing control of what is defined as art, right?
And at the same time, mm-hmm. deeply damaging by pulling back these grants, you know, no advance warning, just from cultural institutions, large and small, all around the country, that often are part of the fabric of communities and also by the economic drivers in many communities, these arts institutions, right? And so that's the whole mix. And you know, announced on the same day that they announced these changes to Smithsonian, and also, and I just have to say this because it so blows my mind, what his plan is for July 4th of next year is a cage match.
Oh, I did not hear about
the White
this.
House. He's going to
a UFC cage match. This 20,000 people on the White House lawn.
This is how he intends to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, a cage match on the White House lawn.
See whether that happens.
UFC fighting is lost upon me. It is one of those things that does make me feel like I've lost touch with the broader culture. I grew up as a boxing fan, but even that would be a little bit weird.
But on a different day, maybe whatever. I'm
not
obviously
about
loves
to defend
it,
that,
but on
Teresa.
July
it just
4th
seems silly.
Of the 250th anniversary.
You know,
it's pretty
Mike,
American.
I will survive.
Mike, if I know I'm horribly late for a break. Should I just skip at this point and then just get out at 50? 58. Okay.
Are we going to survive?
59.
We will survive.
Okay, 58 and a half. Okay, great.
See, this is why the I Will Survive is the anthem, because in every direction.
But wouldn't it be great if the newly named Kennedy Center honor, Sylvester Stallone, was in the UFC match? Like, how cool would that be?
Like, look at how happy you are. I don't care as long as it's not on July 4th. This is how he's envisioning celebrating the birth of our country, by fighting, two people fighting in a cage match. And Ivanka Trump is coming back to put it all together. That was the big news.
Well, he's really
this
into...
Is what she's
that's also
for.
A bizarre twist to the story.
This is what she's coming back for?
Yeah. It's interesting.
Interesting.
But they'll be in ballet tutu, so it'll be refined.
In drag with kiss.
Well, and we
I'm
don't
sorry.
Know and we don't know if this will actually, you know, move forward or not. We have no idea.
It's
but
in
we'll...
it's they're all
I know, I know.
I thought it was a joke when I first saw it yesterday. But then
there is no joke. JP, any thoughts on UFC?
I didn't know about the UFC thing, but the Kennedy Center, it is certainly part of the overall culture war strategy from the president. And Joe, I agree with what you say about not having a host. You know, what my remembrances of the Kennedy Center honors is that it's like a live dinner and a live event, but what we television watchers see is more of a produced hour of television. Is that a fair?
Yes.
Yeah. They tape it in October, early November. It airs around the holidays on CBS.
Yeah. And so what'll be interesting to me is how will it be the same type of hour? Will it be a different format and all that? Because it
said it's going to be different.
And it is.
Said it's going to be quicker and different.
For me, I'm not. I've seen them before, but I wouldn't say it's like a must-watch thing each year. But maybe for different people, it's different. It is a must-watch. You watch every year? Would you say the Kennedy Hour?
Yeah, and I've attended. And it was amazing. It was the year Letterman got inducted.
Wow.
And it was, yeah, it was incredible.
And he wasn't there to buy you a beer?
No. But
black tie, Jeff?
But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
you
wear
cool.
a black tie.
Very cool.
But the thing about it is that it is you know, it looks really good on television. There's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of security because of the President of the United States is there. There is, because there's a large number of musical performances, you have to wait that time. And, you know, so that's one of the reasons that they don't do it live. They'll do it taped, so that all can be taken out. So there's a lot of hurry up and waiting involved in it. But it is thrilling to see and very cool. And there's always, I don't even remember quite who all was on that particular year, but it was wonderful.
And I read the people who produced that, and also I think produced the Mark Twain Prize production at the Ford Theater, are not going to do it this year. But can I, the little bit of trivia.
We have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
President Kennedy spoke 62 fundraiser for the center, arguing that just 1 month after the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, culture had a great practical value in the age of conflict. But the encouragement of art, he told a glittering crowd that included opera singer Marian Anderson, comedian Danny Kaye, and 8-year-old cellist Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo
Ma was at the initial fundraiser. 8-year-old. Isn't that a fun little factoid?
That's great.
We are out of time. My thanks to all. We'll be back right after this.